Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Okay, lecture number 8. Lecture number 8 in Christology. And we're supposed to cover the hypostatic union. First, we talked about the deity of Christ. It's very clear that the scriptures teach that Jesus is God. Now we need to talk about the humanity of Christ. Now, I'm just going to give you the verses and say, tell you what they're teaching in there, and we're not going to have time to turn to them. Reason being is, again, the Docetists and the early Gnostics, early in church history, the big problem was they denied the humanity of Christ. They admitted Jesus was God, but they said because of the teaching of Plato and the Neoplatonists, the guys that had taken on his teachings and took them a step further, there was the idea that the spirit realm is good and the physical realm is evil, matter is evil, therefore God could not take on matter. God could not take on a material form. So Jesus was a phantom. He appeared to be human, but he really wasn't. That was the earlier heresies. We're always denying the humanity of Christ, not so much the deity. Of course, you had the Jewish religious leaders who said he was only a man and he was a false teacher. But nowadays, it's Christ's deity that is questioned. So we spent the whole lecture on his deity, and we're just going to brush through his humanity, but it's very, very clear in the scriptures that Christ was also fully human. He is fully divine. He is fully deity. At the same time, Christ is fully human, fully man. Galatians 4:4, Paul said that he was born of a woman. That sounds like Jesus is human. He was born of a woman. Number 2, he had a body. Matthew 26:12 tells us that he had a body. 2 John 7 says that many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who deny that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. So there's a lot of guys who said that he really didn't come in the flesh, he just appeared to come in the flesh. That was 2 John 7. Remember, 2 John doesn't have any chapters, so verse 7 is it. And also Colossians 2:9, Paul says, "For in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form." He had a body. Jesus also had a soul and spirit. Remember, some guys said that, used to say that Jesus, all he had of his humanity, he just had a body, and the spirit that was inside of him was God. Well, that's not true. Jesus had a human soul and spirit. So Jesus had everything that a human has except for sin nature. Matthew 26:38 said that his soul was troubled. And Luke 23:46, he said, "Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit." Jesus had a human soul and spirit. He also had a body. He had human limitations. What was that? Luke 23:46. Then he also had human limitations. Jesus was limited in knowledge. He's going to create a problem for us. We're going to have to resolve it with the hypostatic union, which is going to be the rest of this lecture. It's limited in knowledge. In Mark 13:32, he said that the Father knows when the day or the hour of the Son's return, but even the Son and the angels don't even know it. So Jesus is saying, "Hey, there's something I don't know." But he's limited in knowledge, like humans are limited in knowledge. In fact, in Luke, I don't even remember the exact passage, but it's in the earlier chapters of Luke, probably Luke 2, maybe. But it says that that Jesus grew, as a child, he grew in strength and in wisdom and in knowledge. So he was learning things. So he was limited in knowledge. Also, he hungered. Jesus hungered. He thirsted. He was weary and he wept. He hungered, he thirsted, he was weary and he wept. It's Matthew 4:2. John 19:28. John 4:6. And John 11:35. He hungered, he thirsted, he was weary, and he wept. He was also tempted. Like all men are tempted, he was tempted. Matthew 4:1, Hebrews 2:18, and Hebrews 4:15. He slept. Matthew 8:24, he slept. So I'm talking about the fact that he had human limitations. He suffered, he bled, and he died. He suffered, bled, and died. 1 Peter 4:1. 1 Peter 4:1. John 19:34. Matthew 27:50. And 1 Corinthians 15:3. 1 Corinthians 15:3. He suffered, bled, and died. And also he prayed to the Father. He communicated with God. Mark 1:35. You know, he prayed to the Father as men prayed to the Father. Mark 1:35 and Luke 11:1. So he's born of a woman. He has a body, a soul, and a spirit. He has human limitations. And he prayed to the Father. It's very obvious, the scriptures teach, that he was human. So now what we're left with is Jesus is God, and Jesus is human. How in the world are we going to reconcile the two? And so the subject of lecture number 8 is the hypostatic union. The hypostatic union. The basic definition, you will see this on a test, is the divine nature plus the human nature in one person forever. When we talk about the deity of Jesus and the humanity of Jesus, Jesus is never going to stop being a man. He is also never going to stop being God. Once, he always existed as God, but at a point in time he became a man. But once he became a man, he's never going to stop being a man. He's going to always exist as fully God and fully man. So the hypostatic union teaches the divine nature of Jesus plus the human nature of Jesus in one person forever. Historians try to make him two persons. Arius try to make him a lesser god. Others just deny the deity. Others, the Gnostics, deny the humanity. The hypostatic union is the biblical teaching that Jesus Christ is fully God and fully man, and he is one person forever. Divine nature plus the human nature in one person forever. So, what it basically, and again in Colossians 2:9, this is brought out, where Paul says, "For in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form." While remaining fully God, Christ took upon himself the full nature of man, yet without sin. In fact, you should be writing these things down verbatim. I know it's going to be a lot of writing. Some of the stuff you should be listening to, it's important stuff, but it's probably a lot of it's master degree level, because I got a lot of it from Tom Morris. While remaining fully God, Christ took upon himself the full nature of man, yet without sin.
Yes.
The next point is that Christ is fully God and fully man. He is not half of each. Jesus Christ is not half man and half God. Jesus Christ is fully God and fully man. He is not half of each. As we mentioned before, what I wrote on the board, the hypostatic union is the deity and humanity of Christ. The deity and humanity of Christ in one person forever. The deity and humanity of Christ in one person forever. It means the divine nature plus the human nature in one person with no blending of the attributes. You don't have God's unlimited power and Jesus' limited power as a man blending together, giving him semi-omnipotence, semi-all power. They don't blend, okay? So the divine nature plus the human nature of one person with no blending of the attributes. There's no loss. He didn't lose his omniscience, his all knowledge. He didn't lose his omnipotence, his all power. He didn't lose his omnipresence, his ability to be in all places at the same time. There is no loss, no mixing, and no altering of the natures. He is fully has the nature of God, and he fully has the nature of man without them blending or a few things being pulled out of there or whatever. Now, the objection that comes up with to the hypostatic union, and by the way, this is what we derive from the scriptures. This is just based on scriptural passages when you pull them all together. What every one of the cults does is they hold to certain passages, but they overemphasize them and they de-emphasize other passages, or they just explain away other passages. We need to take all the passages on the subject. The objection to the hypostatic union is this. It's the idea that to be both God and man is contradictory. To be both God and man is contradictory. That's what they claim. It's impossible. It's a contradiction. Now, I'm going to write on the board some attributes here, and we're going to see. These guys will argue like this. They'll say that God has to be omnipotent. Omnipotent. Learn these words too. Omnipotent means all powerful. Impotent means you're weak, you don't have the power. Omnipotent means all power. God is omnipotent, but man is limited in power. God is sinless. Man is sinful. God is omniscient. Man is limited in knowledge. Let's go on and on. Main thing is that God is infinite. He is unlimited in his attributes. Man is finite. He is limited in his attributes or characteristics. So let's go on and on. God doesn't have a body. Man has a body. And what they're saying is it's impossible to be both omnipotent and limited in power. It's impossible to be both infinite and finite. And so that's where the hypostatic union comes in. We really have to look at it close. And what it basically amounts to, what these people are failing to understand, and they got this from Tom Morris. He's a Christian philosopher at Notre Dame. And he's actually a Protestant that got a job at a Catholic university. And
with him was.
But he's, in some areas I disagree with him, but overall he's pretty good. Read a lot of his books. But he basically makes three major distinctions. One is between essential characteristics and non-essential characteristics. For instance, an essential characteristic of Phil Fernandez being a human is that I have a soul. If I have no soul, I'm not a human being. A non-essential characteristic is I have two arms. If I lose an arm, I'm still a human. I don't have to have two arms to be a human, okay? So having two arms are non-essential to my being a human, but having a soul is essential to my being a human, okay? Does everybody understand that? It's like some are necessary characteristics, essential characteristics, and some are not necessary, though you might have them, okay? Morris also makes a distinction between essential characteristics, those necessary characteristics, and common characteristics. Okay? I'll use the same example. It is very common for men to have two arms. But it's not necessary. You can lose an arm and still be a man. I'll give you another one. It is common, so common that before Christ was born, before Christ was conceived in the womb of Mary, it was so common that every human had it. It is very common for humans to have a sin nature. But it is not necessarily essential. Don't forget, Adam and Eve were created, they were humans, and they didn't have a sin nature until the fall. So there can be something that's common to all other men other than Jesus, but not necessarily be essential to humanity. Right off the bat, the sinless argument falls. Because you can still be sinless and be a man. So right off the bat, we knock one of them right off. But if God could become a man, then there is a sense where man would not be limited in power, but he would still be a man. So what he's saying is certain things are not really not as essential as we might have thought they were. But the other one, this is the key one here, he makes a distinction between being fully human and being merely human. A distinction between being fully human and being merely human. I'll even go so far to say that you can make that distinction and Erickson makes it in his, he calls him being abstract God rather than being God become a man. But you could say merely God and merely human. So let's put this up top here. This is the thing that's left out. What these guys are saying is it's a contradiction to be God and man, because you have to be infinite and finite at the same time. It's impossible. But see, what we're saying is that if you're merely God, you have all these things. And if you're merely man, you have all these things. But there can be some give. For instance, God does not have a body. Man has a body. But you see, Jesus has a body, but he's God. Why? Because he's not merely God. He's not just God. He's also man. So he has a body. But Jesus knows everything. Yeah, because he's not merely man. He's also God. You understand what I'm getting at now? I see a lot of puzzled faces. That's good. I break out the red marker on a test. But merely God means you're just God. If you're just God alone, you don't have a body. Okay? If you're just God alone, you don't have any limitations. You're not finite. You can't be limited in knowledge. But we already showed that it's possible not to be sinful and to be God. But the thing is, Jesus wasn't merely God. Jesus was merely God until he also became a man. Then, not only was he just God, but now all of a sudden he is also man. So he's more than merely God. God the Father is not limited in power. He doesn't have any limitations. He doesn't have a body. But God the Son is not just God. He is not merely God, but he also took on humanity, which means he had as a body with some of the limitations that that body entails. Okay? So you're starting to see where I'm going with this. Let's see if I can give a... He's got both of the... from both groups. Of course, sinful is not necessary to being a man. Adam and Eve, at one time, were humans and they weren't sinful. So with these distinctions, I by the way, add a fourth one. Morris alludes to it, I believe. By the way, Morris' book is called The Logic of God Incarnate. In fact, I haven't even read it. I haven't even found where I can buy it. I don't even know if it's still in print. It should be, though. But just about every working Christology that's been written the last 2 or 3 years quotes heavily from Morris, at least if they're evangelicals in their book. And so you get an overview of his writings. But apparently he's real deep on into this. But a fourth distinction that I would add is a distinction between being fully human and being fallen human. A distinction between being fully human and being in a fallen state of humanity. In other words, if anybody wasn't fully human, don't blame Jesus. Jesus is fully human. If anybody's not fully human, it's us. Because we took a nosedive towards the animals when we sinned in the garden. If anybody's not fully human, it'd be us, not Jesus. In other words, when we added a sin nature, we became less human rather than Jesus, but not having a sin nature makes him less human. We've got more than a human should have. We're abnormal. He's a normal human because he's perfect in his humanity. And but anyway, Morris' solution, I'm going to read 5 things to you. And just listen to them. See if you make sense. If you're a quick writer, jot them down. You can, if you want to stay a little later and you want to jot them down yourself, you could do that. You might see 1 or 2 of these on a test. I doubt I'll get this deep on the test. My main thing, I really believe in teaching everybody to be real good theologians at the same time. I'm not an ogre, and what my main thing is when you hear error, you recognize it. So you hear some deep stuff on the true or false, because I want you to be able to know error when you hear it. But at the same time, I'll read this stuff to you. If you take real quick notes, if you know shorthand, go to town on it. And Morris' solution, those are some of the things that that would come from this type of thought. While it is essential that God is omnipotent, that means all-powerful, while it is essential that God is omnipotent, omniscient, that means all-knowing, sinless, and infinite, while it is essential that God is omnipotent, omniscient, sinless, and infinite, it is not essential that a human must be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, sinful and finite. In other words, it is possible to be a human and not be sinful. It is possible to be a human and to have a nature that is not limited. Okay? So you see what he's saying? That these things are common among all other humans except Jesus, but it's not necessary. You can still be human and also have a divine nature. We keep comparing Jesus with mere humans and say, well, therefore, he's not human. He's different than us in these areas. But Jesus is not a mere human. Yes, he is fully human. He has everything that we have except the sin nature. But he's different in another way, and that is he is also fully God. So when we look at Jesus, we can't just examine Jesus to say, well, he's either man or God. No, he is man and God. Fully man and fully God. Number two, Mars says, it is common for humans to be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, sinful, and finite. It is common for humans to be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, sinful, and finite, but it is not essential for them to be so. So once you understand the distinctions, these things just naturally flow. Once you understand the distinctions, you hear this stuff and say, yeah, okay, it sounds, makes sense. It is common for humans to be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, sinful, and finite, but it's not essential for them to be so. That'd be the same thing as saying, it is very common for humans to have two arms, but it's not essential. You can't find humans with one arm.
When you talk about finite and infinite, what are you referring to as far as that?
Pretty much everything. In other words, finite means you're limited, and infinite means you're not limited. So pretty much that's really the basic argument.
As far as what, though?
I mean, as far as everything, pretty much.
You're talking
not limited. We say God is infinite.
Talking about the base nature. I mean, because he's
God.
I mean, as having a physical body, he can be everything.
Yes, he can. But
physical.
Yeah, but not physical. Yeah. See, and that's where Christ is unlimited, but he is limited. Because you don't mix the attributes. In his deity, he is unlimited. In his humanity, he is limited in some ways. That's so one of the Lutherans are the only Protestants that hold this view that the body, that Christ is also omnipresent in his body, as well as spiritually, and no other Protestants hold that. And what they do is they're trying to disagree with the Catholics on their view of the Lord's Supper, transubstantiation, and they have consubstantiation as the name they come up with, but they're trying to still put the body and blood of Christ in the host without holding the transubstantiation. But the basic Protestant view is that Christ bodily sits at the Father's right hand, and there is a center of human consciousness in the whole nine yards there. I mean, he is there. But he is also in his divine nature everywhere at once. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Paul talks about a mystery. Christ in you, the hope of ages. Paul says, it's not me doing this, but Christ lives in me. And he's doing it. So we are indwelt by the triune God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Not only the Holy Spirit, even the Son indwells us as well. So it's kind of, Jesus did not take anything away from himself when he became a man. He added to himself. In fact, even in the kenosis, the divine emptying, Warfield, Benjamin Warfield points out that there's a passage where they translated it in a wooden, literal fashion, and they shouldn't have. It'd be like, The way the Jews and the Greeks used to use it back then would be like if you say, suppose that I went over to Tom Thompson's house and I get over there and I'm going over for supper and I get there early and he's wearing an apron and he's cooking. And I suppose that I was one of these chauvinistic guys where guys aren't supposed to cook. I can't cook and I suffer for that now. But every once in a while my wife's not home and it's break out the Cheerios and milk. So if I get there and I'm one of these chauvinistic guys and I don't think guys should wash dishes, I don't think guys should cook the food. Okay? And by the way, my wife is, she does all that stuff. I do better than anything. I don't even change the oil in my car. But she doesn't do that. The oil in my car goes unchanged. When the oil light comes on and it runs out of oil, I fill it back up. Man, I'm going to... And again, it calls for IBD. I'm going to have to remember to keep that thing off the hook.
How can he add... If he's the omnipotent, omniscient God, how can he add to himself? I don't understand that.
But, see, the being... infinite. God created everything else. And that's where some people try to say, being infinite being means that there is nothing outside of your own being that could limit you. Okay? Now, John Hick, he's a Princeton theologian who's apostatized in the faith, and he's tried to argue that for God to be unlimited means that there can't be anything except God. For God to be unlimited means God has to be everything. If there's anything that God is not, there's a limitation on him. In actuality, because God is not temporal matter, it's not a limitation to God, it's actually a strength to God. And because God cannot fail, it's not a limitation to God, it's actually a strength to God. So, though infinite, it's a lot deeper of a concept, and it needs to be examined more closely by theologians and philosophers alike. What it ends up coming out to is there is nothing that could limit him and make him fail or whatever. He will always succeed. There is nothing that limits his power or his strength.
So it exists in nature. He can create that which is outside of himself, and then basically, what does Jesus interact and become a part of it?
But there's also God also interacts with creation, just the fact that he keeps it in existence. He keeps everything in existence as well. Let me read through the rest of these, and maybe we'll have time for questions. Okay, number three. Mere humans must be non-omniscient. Mere humans must be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, and finite. Mere humans must be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, and finite. But a human who is also God, in other words, he's not just a mere human, he's fully human, but he's not just a mere human, he's not just God, but he also took on humanity. But a human who is also God would not be a mere human, though he would be fully human. A human who is also God would be omnipotent, omniscient, and infinite. Let me repeat the whole thing again. Mere humans must be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, and finite. But a human who is also God would not be a mere human, though he would be fully human. A human who is also God would be omnipotent, omniscient, and infinite. Again, though, too, is he's got two natures. It's kind of like if I'm driving in a truck with a guy says, "Oh, man, I ran out of gas." And I think it's the end of the world, and I don't know even how they do it, but he switches over to, he's got two gas tanks, and he switches to another gas tank, and then we just go right on driving. You see, it'd be impossible in my car, the cars that myself and my wife own, it'd be impossible for us to be both empty on gas and full on gas at the same time. But some trucks have two gas tanks where you can be empty on gas and full on gas. Because when you talk about that truck, you've got to talk about both tanks. With Jesus Christ, you could say he is limited, but you could also say he is unlimited. Because you're talking about more than one tank.
It all depends on how you look at it.
Well, in other words, human nature and divine nature.
In your truck, he's not really empty. Because he has that additional gas. If you look at the whole truck as a whole, he was never empty in the first place.
Yeah, and it's like if you look at the whole person as a whole Jesus, does Jesus know everything? Yes. Is that truck on full? Yes.
Does the truck on
gas? Yes. So if you look at Jesus as a whole, but if you still look at Jesus as far as his human nature, he has limitations. But if you look at him from his divine nature, he has no limitations. So if you look at him overall, the divine, really, you don't blend the two, but the divine wins out. Does Jesus have limitations? No. As a person, as when you take everything all, when you take all the factors together, can he do anything? You bet he can. But when you look at him as from his human nature, he has limitations. And so just like driving that truck with two gas tanks, it can be empty. The truck can have an empty tank of gas, but still have a full tank of gas. And so What is it? What is the final conclusion of the thing? You've got a full tank of gas. Same with Christ. Number four, fallen humans are essentially sinful. Fallen humans are essentially sinful. Fallen humans are essentially sinful, but a non-fallen human can be sinless. Fallen humans are essentially sinful, but a non-fallen human can be sinless. And then point number five. Point number five. A person who was merely God would not have a body. A person who was merely God would not have a body. A person who was merely God would not have a body. But a person who is God, a person who was merely God would not have a body, but a person who is God could also become fully human, and thus have a human body. I'll say that again. A person who is merely God would not have a body, but a person who is God could become also fully human and thus have a human body. But then he would no longer be merely God. He would be fully God and fully man. But then he would no longer be merely God. He would be fully God and fully man. I'll read that one again. A person who was merely God would not have a body, but a person who is God could also become fully human and thus have a human body. But then he would no longer be merely God. He would be fully God and fully man. We could say that, supposing we took a vote in the church and we decided only the members of the church could vote. And somebody says, well, okay, Joe Schmo is a regular at our church. He comes regularly. And I want him to vote. Somebody would say, well, he's a regular, but he's merely a regular. He's not a member. Okay? So if you were a regular and merely a regular, you would not have voting power. But if you were a regular visitor to the church, a regular at the church, but also a member, then you would have voting power. The difference is between a mere regular and a regular who is also a member. And with Christ, it's the difference between being merely a man and being a man who is also God. And it's the difference between being merely God and God who also is a man, became a man. So I hope we understand those distinctions. And with that, we got about 5 minutes left. If you want to leave right now, that's fine. If you want to ask questions, ask questions for 5 minutes. I'm going to ask Al to keep the camera running for this 5 minutes for those questions. Any questions?
Can you repeat number three again?
Okay, number three, mere humans must be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, and finite. Mere humans must be non-omniscient, non-omnipotent, and finite, but a human who is also God, which means he wouldn't be a mere human, but a human who is also God would not be a mere human. But a human who is also God would not be a mere human, though he would be fully human. A human who is also God would be omnipotent, omniscient, and infinite. And obviously that's in his divine nature. He would also have the human limitations in the human nature. What's really, really tough about the hypostatic union is the more you talk about it, the more you increase the possibility of becoming heretical. So you have to, in other words, it's like no matter how good of a swimmer you are, the deeper the water, The further out in the ocean you get into, the better chance you got of drowning. And that's the way it is here. A lot of these great thinkers of church history try to go too far in their thinking, and they ended up reaching contradictions. But one thing I will say is, if we're going to preach Jesus as both God and man, we're going to have to answer the objections of those who say that to be fully God and fully man is a contradiction. I think Tom Morris has gone a long way in that area. Miller J. Erickson has done a lot, especially with the kenosis. That's what we'll be talking about in the next lecture. By the way, your first paper, in fact, your only paper for this course. I'm going to start real small. I want you to just print it. You can type if you want, double space. But I wouldn't mind you printing it all. And double space, leave a space, because I want to make corrections in the whole nine yards. But on your first paper, it's got to be 3 pages long. And I want you to discuss for about a page or so the hypostatic union. You could be a little longer than 3 pages if you want, even a little shorter, but right around the 3 pages. You know, even if you hand me something 7 pages, I'll sit through it. I want 3 sections, the hypostatic union, the kenosis, and the true view of the atonement. Now, we're going to cover them in the lectures, but they're also in your textbooks. And if you want to draw from either the lectures or the textbook or from both of them, that's fine. But 3 pages long, double space, skip a line. And I'm not going to try to get you to... If you decide, you can talk about the false views and then give the correct view. But that's going to be pretty hard to do in a small amount of space. What I really want to know is that John Gardner, who attended the lectures, knows the true view of the hypostatic union, the true view of the kenosis, and the true view of the atonement. Well, let me tell you something, too. This is very scary. This is just basic. Before the 20th century, it was just assumed. These things, it's like the Trinity. The word Trinity is nowhere in the Bible, but it speaks. That word Trinity takes about 300 verses. Well, it's taught 300 verses. It puts it all together, and we get the word Trinity. It's the same with these things, and they're talking biblical truth and all, but maybe possibly more than half of the pastors in America today probably couldn't even do that paper just off the top of their head. And the sad thing is that, and I'll tell you, we'll just close with this. Second Peter, I'm just going to run this by. By the way, Jesus did not go to the seminaries. He didn't go to the Bible colleges to get his apostles. He went to regular people. So a lot of people just say, well, then he's not into having pastors who have Bible college education. Wrong. Because what did he do for the next 3.5 years? He taught those boys day and night. He taught them through example. He taught them through word. He even got frustrated when he said, Philip said, show us the Father. He said, Philip, how long have I been with you guys? He has seen me, have seen the Father. But he taught these guys. And you can't tell me when you read 1st and 2nd Peter, and when you read the Gospel of John, you can't tell me that these guys were unschooled idiots. They were geniuses. They were experts in what Jesus had taught them. And when you look at the writings of Paul, Paul was a guy who was seminary trained. Paul was a guy who had probably been trained since he was a child and was a great thinker. And that's why Peter says about him, 2 Peter chapter 3, he says this in verses 14 to 17. Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless, and regard the patience of our Lord to be salvation, just as also our beloved brother Paul, according to the wisdom given him, wrote to you, as also in all his letters, speaking in them of these things, in which are some things hard to understand, which the untaught and unstable distort, as they do the rest of the Scriptures to their own destruction. You therefore, beloved, knowing this beforehand, Be on your guard lest, being carried away by the error of unprincipled men, you fall from your own steadfastness. I get sick and tired of hearing untaught and unstable guys that are not trained in the Word, saying, touch not God's anointed. Because some preacher is sleeping in bed with some woman other than his wife, and they say, touch not God's anointed. Let me tell you something. He lost the anointing. That man's not called to preach. If a man can't be faithful to his wife, God has not called him to preach the Word. Maybe God had called him earlier, but God's taking that back until that man gets disciplined, until that man turns around and shows a few years of evidence of a changed life. But let me tell you right now, there's a lot of guys out there that are uneducated as far as the Bible is concerned, and they're starting mega churches with 5, 10, 15,000 people. They're starting cults like Joseph Smith and the Mormon faith and Russell and the Jehovah's Witnesses and the whole nine yards. And the only way you're going to be able to see through them is if you study the Word. Peter, I think Peter would be totally against the idea of just reading Paul through once and then giving a talk on what you think he said. You need to be in the Word. We need to study to show ourselves approved. Second Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15, the Apostle Paul told us, study to show thyself approved. It used to be a memorization verse of mine, but obviously my memory is failing. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15. And then we'll close with that. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15. Paul tells Timothy, a young man that he was trained to be a preacher of the Word, be diligent. That means hard working. Be diligent to present yourself approved to God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed. You know who a workman is who is ashamed? It's a guy that when his boss returns, you didn't do your job. You didn't do everything you were supposed to do. Paul says, be diligent to present yourself approved to God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, handling accurately the word of truth. King James Version says, study to show thyself approved. That's what it's about. You got to get out there and study the Word. By the way, you guys here, not every Christian's called for deep studies like this. But if you're going to be Christian leaders, and if you're going to want to teach other people in the whole nine yards, then you need this kind of thing. Every pastor should have had this kind of thing, either from here or just reading the books. There's some godly men with no Bible training at all, but they've read the Bible, they've read the works of other men who've read the Bible, dedicated their whole lives to the Bible, and they come up with an education. I don't care if the education is formal or informal. If you're going to get behind a pulpit, you better know what you're talking about. And unfortunately, the Christian church in America today, we've got a lot of flakes out there for untrained and unlearned men. I don't care if you went to the great Bible colleges like Liberty or Multnomah, or if you just bought the books and studied them yourself and studied the Word. There's some guys that are just such great minds, they can study the Word of God and that's it. And they just are so grounded in the truth. But what's real tough is it's been translated from other languages. And so sometimes even the translation might be a little bit off.